This podcast includes graphic descriptions of battlefield injuries and discussion of suicide. There are details of organisations which can offer you further information and support on our website. You can find it at bfbs.com/audience support.
Hello, welcome to The Moment That Made Me. This time,
we were going back to back on some days on these merch shouts to collect soldiers off the battlefield, and obviously seen many soldiers pay the ultimate price.
An RAF veteran who served 10 tours of duty in Afghanistan shares her inspirational story of recovery from the very darkest point of her life.
I woke up that morning and just decided that today was going to be my last day on Earth. Whenever I did take the overdose, all I wanted to do was die. And as soon as I came out the other side of that, all I wanted to do was live. And I keep pinching myself, you know, I look at where I am now and I never expected this.
Liz McConaughey has chosen the 15th of August 2020 when she woke up in hospital as the moment that made her.
Being a Chinook crewman, we are essentially the eyes and ears of the pilots. The pilots fly the Chinook around and we do all the shop floor, as I call it. I was a very proud crewman. You know, I joined the military at age 19 because I'd seen a magazine with a crewman on the front of it, and it was all I'd ever wanted to be. So for me, you know, that job in the military wasn't just a job, it was who I was. It was very much the fibres of what made me. And part of the, I guess, the slice of time that I joined up, I joined a week after 9/11. And that meant that I was very lucky, I feel, that I got to go to Iraq twice and then off to Afghanistan on Up Herrick 10 times. So I certainly pulled my weight and more in that role. But I think, you know, again, I was quite lucky that I did have that slice of time to go and do those deployments. And I guess to do my job and to make a difference, which was really all I ever wanted to do. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I joined the forces.
Yeah, and you joined straight out of school, didn't you? You were just 19. It was actually your 19th birthday, right? Something you obviously really wanted to do. Can you tell me a little bit about, the kind of experiences you'd had up until that point? Because you'd had a lot of kinetic experience in the battlefields in Afghanistan.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Iraq, for me, and the time I was in Iraq, the war fighting had finished and most of the stuff we were seeing in Iraq was day-to-day tasking and fairly routine. And then when we went on Up Herrick, things ramped up very quickly. You know, again, in the start, it was pretty benign because Camp Bastion didn't exist. And then once we built Camp Bastion, we injected lots of British soldiers into the Helmand Valley. That's when I think things started to really ramp up in terms of the kinetic things that I was seeing and witnessing. So being shot at regularly was pretty routine. Part of the MERT, which was the Medical Emergency Response Team, and that's essentially the flying ambulance. You know, we went from picking up vehicle incidents and people falling off buildings to really some quite traumatic injuries from blast injuries and gunshot wounds and things like that, and multiple casualties, you know, not just British forces, but anyone caught in the crossfire and any of those soldiers that were out there. So it got, you know, we were going back to back on some days on these merch shouts to collect soldiers off the battlefield, and obviously seen many soldiers pay the ultimate price, which did certainly leave its mark on me many, many years later. And of course, you know, flying is inherently dangerous. So I've had my plenty of near misses, not just with bullets, but with other things in Afghanistan as well. So there was a lot of things, I think, looking back now, that probably spiked my adrenaline more than I realised. But we have all got, I think, as military people, very good coping mechanisms to get through when you need to. And so you can go back and do the same again and really help those people when they need you the most.
Incredibly intense moments, I think it must have been. How did it affect you?
So weirdly, at the time, I didn't think it was affecting me. You know, I mentioned earlier, we had a job. So, you know, we had to go back in. And I remember in my early career as a crewman, my instructor telling me, you know, it's all about the guy in the ditch, Liz. It's all about those soldiers on the ground. That's why we have a job. That's why we exist. And yeah, you know, it was the worst kind of injuries, I think. You know, it certainly affected you a little bit more when it was British boots. And it was, you know, you see British combats lying on the stretcher in front of you. And I think we all got very good at blocking it out. You know, I think, you know, people were affected by different things. Some people picking up kids really affected them. I remember one particular incident seeing a different set of boots on a soldier that were quite like my husband's boots at the time. He was in the military, and that affected me a little bit more. And I think, you know, those certain home connections that were the one thing that sometimes got under your skin. But in the main, we just tried to zone out from it. And I knew that I had desensitized to it. On my last merch out, when we were collecting an American casualty from Fob Edinburgh, which is halfway up the Helmand Valley. And actually, when he came over, he'd already died, and the body came on covered in the Stars and Stripes. And I was handed his foot in a clear plastic bag. And I remember just putting it at my feet like it was the most normal thing in the world, because we had become so desensitized to all that trauma, which is quite a dangerous place to be.
Yeah, and from those kind of very intense experiences, you did leave the RAF. I think you were 37 years old. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
How and why did you leave?
So sadly, the Chinook is not a kind aircraft on the body. And, you know, I'd done 3,000 flying hours by this point. You know, I'd certainly as they had a fairly full career flying on the back of that vibrating machine. And it started to interfere with my neck. And I developed some fairly severe neck pain after Op Herrick finished. You know, I came back from my last deployment out there and my neck really, really started to manifest. So I was grounded. Even the medics at Headley Court, the professionals couldn't fix me to put me back in the air. So I was medically discharged in 2019. And again, you know, a career that I absolutely loved, it was who I was, all ended very quickly overnight. You know, I always use the analogy, I was kind of walking along this yellow brick road quite merrily, kind of following it blindly in life, thinking that my career path was mapped out for me. And then overnight, that all changed and the yellow bricks in front of me started to crumble and I had absolutely no idea what I was going to do next.
So that was 17 years in the RAF, done with, gone.
Gone.
Tell me about the moment that you have chosen for the moment that made you in August 2020.
So I thought I was okay when I left the military and I had about a year or so kind of pepper potting between jobs. It's fair to say I think most veterans do that whenever they leave. They try to find that sense of purpose again because, you know, when we take the uniform off, you know, that seed to serve doesn't go away. And I absolutely wanted to continue to make a difference in life. So I found myself working for a great little disabled flying charity down the road from Odeon where I'd been based. And things in the main seemed okay until lockdown hit in 2020. And when lockdown hit in 2020, the world got very quiet very quickly. And that's when everything in my head started getting very, very noisy. I think I'd used various coping mechanisms for that trauma, such as running was one of them. You know, I kind of could just about run a mile and a half when I joined the RAF. And then I almost became the Forrest Gump of Camp Bastion because I would just run. You know, after a bad day in March, that was how I emptied the bucket. And that coping mechanism was taken away very early on in lockdown. It also, you know, kept busy. That's one thing we all do whenever you're starting to suffer internally. Just don't think about it. Just keep busy and don't sit still. And that was absolutely, I look back now and know that was a coping mechanism I was using. And as I say, lockdown hit and all of that was gone. So I developed insomnia and that manifested really, really quickly. And insomnia, you know, sleep underpins everything we do. And that I started to unravel very quickly. And I knew that I was in a really, really dangerous place. When one evening I couldn't sleep and I got my logbook out and I started to look up those casualties from Mert who hadn't made it on the back of my aircraft and really humanize them, you know, look up their backstories and one of the chaps had proposed to his fiancée before he deployed and never made it home. And it continued and gathered pace and it turned, got so bad that one day in August, 13th of August in 2020, I woke up that morning and just decided that today was going to be my last day on Earth without a single emotion, no emotion attached to that thought or feeling, and decided that night I was going to take a huge overdose and try and end my life and kind of spent the entire day planning it with meticulous precision, but again, absolutely no emotion attached to it. And at midnight, I sat in the end of my bed and took a huge overdose and was very lucky that I survived.
And how was it that you survived, thankfully?
So I woke up 2 days later in high dependency unit in Basingstoke Hospital. I didn't actually know where I was at the time. I remember waking up. I had a tube down my throat, one of those intubation tubes, and I couldn't breathe. And the irony is I've got Just Breathe tattooed on the inside of my wrist and I couldn't breathe. So I was trying to pull this tube to pull it out and they put me back to sleep again. And they brought me around a second time and they started explaining to me that I'd been brought into hospital and I could see a clock at the end of the bed and the clock said 6:30. And it was bright. So I kind of figured out it was 6:30 and I thought it was the next morning. It wasn't. It was actually 2 days later. And the doctors kind of started to give me as much information as they knew, which was I'd been brought in by ambulance and that my heart was okay. That was the main thing they were worried about. But I had no idea. I remember thinking, well, who called an ambulance? You know, who made that phone call? Was it a neighbour? Was it a friend? Who found me? And it was only subsequently 2 days later when I was released from hospital that I was reunited with my phone. And myself and my best friend went through the call log and it turned out that I'd actually called the Samaritans for 13 seconds and then straight after that I'd called 911. I'm not sure why not 999, but I'd called 911 and was on that phone, on that particular phone call for 11 minutes. Phone calls I don't even remember making, but I guess it proves to all of us that actually when you're in the darkest times and you hear people, you know, fighting for their lives at the side of a road traffic accident, when you are fighting for your life, you know, there's a will inside us all to survive, even as it's subconscious will. And that made that phone call that night. And as I thankfully, it was those medics that picked me up and saved me.
And why was it the moment that it made you?
Well, because I kind of, up until that point, I had been what I think was infallible. You know, being a female in that kind of crewman world, I was one of the only females. I was the only female for 4 years, and then I was one of the only ones for most of my career. But I think I put an internal pressure on myself. It was never came from any of the lads, by the way. They always just embraced me as one of the team. But I put this pressure from within to never, ever be weak, to never be the girl crying around the back of a tent, even though many of the guys did. I didn't want to be that cliche, and to always be on top of my game for everything. And that actually meant that I was pretty robotic in my lifestyle, in my behaviours, pretty untouchable, and had my stuff squared away. And I even look at kind of the example I was setting to the females who were coming behind me, and I think I was so unapproachable because I just had no chinks in my armour. And when I woke up after the overdose, I guess that was the biggest point of, you know, I guess breaking. And I realized after that, you know, just that we're all human. I'm putting life back together. It was certainly the hardest battle of my life so far. You know, I've been to war zones 12 times, but this was the hardest battle. It was to start to put all those files in order that I'd thrown on the floor that day. I really processed the trauma that I'd seen over the years, but I realized that it really is human to have thoughts like that. You know, we experience trauma, and the body's response is to cry. And I had never let myself cry in 17 years. You know, you run, you fall, you cut your knee, and your knee bleeds. And here I was just stopping my body's natural response. So I think through the process of recovery, I started to realize that, you know, it is okay to be human. It is okay to fail, and that you will learn more from failure than you ever will from success. And essentially now I have become a much more rounded person. I think I'm much more approachable, hopefully. And I'm much more, you know, I look inward a lot more to kind of really understand who I am as a person. Because I think, you know, looking back now, I thought that the uniform defined me for my whole career. You know, I was Liz McConaughey, the Chinook crewman. And what I realize now that, you know, the uniform doesn't define you. You define the uniform. And you're the same person inside, even when you take that uniform off. And it took me a long time to really process, like, who was I really? Because it was the same set of eyes looking back in the mirror from, like, my, you know, 19-year-old self on day one in the military to here I am as my 37-year-old self as a veteran. So I kind of had to really pull all that apart and put it back together again. And hopefully, you know, I got a second chance at life. And I think I'm hopefully making the best of it now.
And Liz, when you woke up, if you don't mind me asking, after taking that overdose, how did you feel? Because your intention when you took it was not to wake up.
Yeah, and that's a really good question. And, you know, it's fair to say that whenever I did take the overdose, all I wanted to do was die. And as soon as I came out the other side of that, all I wanted to do was live. And I look back now and think that's how trauma and PTSD can really affect your brain so badly. Because, and I've only learned this throughout all of my kind of counselling career, which would have been very useful information to have previously. But whenever we put on a uniform, even if you never deployed to war, you stand in a parade square and someone shouts in your face and you're taught not to run away, not to crumble. You're taught to shoot a weapon and not recoil from that fire. And then if you do deploy, you're taught to go to the fight. You know, it's the classic fight or flight response. You know, the lion comes into the room. Most normal people would run out of the room, but we as military are trained to stay and fight. And that overcomes part of your brain, your fight or flight response, which is your normal reasoned thought. And I had been overcoming that reasoned thought process for years and years and years, and essentially pumping different chemicals into my brain to overcome that response. And here, I think, you know, I look back to the day of the overdose and my reasoned thought was just out the window. It seemed like the most normal thing in the world to want to die. You know, I remember writing a suicide note to my parents without a single tear in my eye. I had just mentally checked out of life that day. And a lot of that is to do with brain injuries. You know, if you have PTSD or depression, your brain can just trick itself into thinking things aren't true. So when I did come out the other side of it, my overwhelming emotion was, oh my God, I want to survive. And I think, you know, that proves to all of us that, you know, when you get, if you ever get to that point, I really hope anyone watching or listening never gets to the point where I got to, but don't believe your brain. Go and find someone, get hold of someone and tell them how you're feeling, because they will be able to talk that sense into you to know that it's not the case and your brain is tricking you. I didn't have that because, again, we were locked down. So I think, you know, hopefully that's a takeaway for anyone listening today.
And Liz, so you wake up and you have this overwhelming will to live and to survive, and you'd hit rock bottom. You've been in what you thought was the worst place, but that's where the hard work started.
Yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't an upward trend since then. You know, I feel very lucky that I was a veteran, because I went straight into my counselling about a week later. And I had lots of speaking counselling on Zoom and in person, and I had lots of various different forms of therapy. But it wasn't an upward trend, and I hit another pothole again along the way when it got to Remembrance that year. I think Remembrance is hard for a lot of us veterans. And funny enough, when I was serving, it never seemed to affect me in the same way as it did suddenly whenever I'd left. And so I hit another really hard patch in the November, and I had another moment where I thought I could just end this all now. That would be the easiest option. And thankfully recognized those feelings this time and reached out to the doc straight away and was able to get help. And it's something I do. I always tell everyone these days to give their mental health a number, because I think if you give your mental health a number of 10, it's so much easier to meet your friends and say, I'm a 3 out of 10 today. You don't have to tell them why, just say you're a 3 out of 10, but it means that your friends can keep a good eye on you. You know, if you're 9 out of 10, they don't have to worry about you that week. But it also means that you can monitor your own mental health so much better. And I now always give my mental health a number so I can kind of identify those trends and see that if I've been in number 2 or 3 for a few days running, maybe a week or so, it's probably time to reach out and get a bit of help again, or to put some coping mechanisms in. And I think, you know, it will always, for anyone who's been through any trauma, PTSD, depression, you know, there is no magic wand to fix it, but with the right love, support, tools and people around you, you can recover. And I always say this, PTSD is a chapter of my book. It's a chapter of my life, but it doesn't define me going forward. You really can recover from it. And I think I'm better for the experiences that I've had with that, because I can now see it in other people. I can hopefully offer a bit of advice, and I'm certainly more self-aware. So never look at someone who's got PTSD or been through that as, you know, a label to them or a broken crayon, which that saying is used so prolifically, broken crayons, still call it the same. And I know the sentiment is actually really positive, but they're not broken crayons and they can recover fully at the other side of it.
And when you were going through that recovery process, could you draw at all on your military training to help you?
Yeah, I think things like a lot of the, I guess, physical fitness was a huge part of recovery. You know, that, you know, just get out and move your body. That was one of the things I put in as a coping mechanism before my meltdown, I guess, and my sort of spiraling out of control. And I think that was one of the parts that was a main cog in the recovery, really, is just that movement for mental health. I realized I was now a little bit older and couldn't run marathons anymore, but certainly just getting out and walking with your friends. You know, I used to put my earphones in and just disappear off for miles on end running, and that was me emptying the bucket. But now I realized that actually taking the earphones out and having a 20-minute walk with some friends, you get the same value. And I think, you know, that problem shared is a problem halved saying is so, so true. So I think that really helped. And I think, you know, a lot of the less so the tools that the military gave me, but more the people that the military gave me, was a huge factor in me getting better as well. You know, anyone who's been in the military will always say the thing they miss the most is the people, because you make friends for life and they're like family, and they have absolutely been by my side in every step of the recovery. And initially, whenever I came out of hospital and I did see some of them, their overwhelming emotion was really angry. They were so angry that I didn't reach out and ask them for help. And I think, you know, it comes back to that I just didn't want to be a burden on anyone. But now when they understand how I got to that point and what my thoughts were in the day, they've just been there every turn to kind of helping me recover.
You mentioned earlier that you'd had previous near-death experiences, and in particular, one, you'd already survived a near-fatal incident in Afghanistan when your Chinook helicopter hit overhead wires. How do you feel about the impact of that moment and the one where you tried to take your own life? Did they affect you in similar or different ways?
So that's really odd that you say that. And so I'm glad you brought it up, because I did have a wire strike, which was probably my nearest moment to dying in Afghanistan. It was very early on in my career. And I never really give it a second thought after that, because yes, we nearly crashed. We all nearly died, but we didn't. And that's what a lot of military people go, yes, but we survived. So you try not to revisit those moments too often. And then obviously in Helmand, so much other stuff happened after that I very rarely revisited that day. And 2 weeks before my overdose, another Chinook here in the UK had hit a set of wires near Wales and had to land on. And it was one of my really good friends that was on the back of the aircraft. And I remember seeing the Sun, the Daily Mail headlines with the pictures of the aircraft. And she sent me the pictures through. And they were almost a carbon copy of my accident. And I don't know if that had an impact on what happened 2 weeks later. I don't know if that's what really started to trigger the unraveling. But I know that we are, as military people, very good at locking things away for years and years and never revisiting them. And I think sometimes it takes something completely out of the unknown when you're least expecting it that might just unlock that box and start to trickle feed those emotions that you've been locked away for years. So I guess it's just a message for everyone.
What did that moment in August 2020 teach you about yourself?
It taught me that I can, there's a will inside me to survive. I think it taught me that I am much stronger than I really give myself credit for. You know, I remember looking back at that moment and feeling very weak, very disjointed, and like a letdown for, you know, I'd had this, such an incredible career and it was all over and that was it. And I was in a scrap heap. And actually, you know, I look back now and think that, you know, like I said earlier, the fibers of who you are that make you up inside, all those colourful things that happened to me in Afghanistan, the crashes, the merch outs, all those things, they weave themselves into the fibre that make you who you are. So I am a much more colourful person than I give myself credit for. I have got so many fibres and strings that make me up because of those experiences. And I think I never really give myself credit for all of that. It's only now that I can say very, very proudly and very confidently that I am a veteran. And before that, I kept referring to myself in the previous tense and saying I used to be a Chinook crewman. And it was only throughout my counselling, my counsellor said, Liz, you need to let that person go, let that person die, because ultimately that was the past. Be proud of it, but embrace who you are now. And I think that day in August, you know, 2020, it's led to me being extremely proud of who I am today. Not just who I was.
Who are you, Liz? How has it changed you?
So I'm a veteran, like I said. I'm a survivor, and I've become a writer, which is one thing I never thought I'd say. And it's always very strange whenever you're introducing people and they ask, "What do you do?" And you explain that you're an author, because that, from a crewman point of view, was something I never ever thought I would get to. And it's almost like August 2020 has given me a completely new persona, a new lease of life. And it's helped me find my actual true passion in life, which was writing. But I think, the things that you think that make you, we all love a label, and I don't care what anyone says. When people say people don't like labels and people don't want labels, we all need one. And whenever you introduce yourself to someone, nearly everyone says, "Hi, I'm Liz. I'm whatever," and I was really missing that label. So I think I've now got the chance to kind of repackage what I am and use really positive affirmations at the end of, "I'm Liz, I'm a writer, I'm a best-selling author."
Yeah. You're also a motivational speaker as well, and you go around also talking about mental health as well, and you have a clothing range. I mean, it's quite a very career you developed for yourself.
Yeah, and I keep pinching myself. You know, I look at where I am now, and I never expected this, even when the book came out, because the book was written in 3 weeks. It was written as a cathartic kind of diary experience, really, during my counselling.
This was your memoirs, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was stayed on my laptop with no intention of anyone ever reading it. And then when it did come out and it sold out overnight, I thought, well, that's all my friends and family buying it. And then it sold out on the second print run, and I thought, well, that's not friends and family. And then I started to get reviews through, and I just thought, it's like people marking your homework and giving you 5 stars. So I was very, very lucky in that respect. And then, yeah, I now do motivational speaking, which has given me that sense of purpose back again and that passion. And I think that's the one thing the military gave me so much of, identity, purpose and passion. And it was the one thing I'd really lost during that kind of in-between time during lockdown. So I've got that back again. And yeah, more recently, I've got a clothing range out as well, which again, people ask me, where do you see yourself in a year's time? And I don't even want to think about that, because I'm really enjoying the excitement and kind of every week changes. And one question I get asked all the time is, what advice would you give your 16-year-old self? And I thought for ages about something really profound. And then I thought, you know what? I wouldn't tell her anything, because I've enjoyed my career so much because it was all so new and exciting and fresh. And, you know, I think that novelty factor kind of got me through a lot of my basic training and escape and evasion training and all the toughest moments of my life in my early career, because it was new and exciting. And if you knew what was coming in life, so many of us wouldn't do the things we do. So I don't want to know what's happening in a year's time, but I just keep it going positively.
And Liz, one thing that's really interesting when you talk about your moments, the moment that made you, is that you talk about these kind of files that have been put away, and you had to kind of, when you addressed what happened, you had to kind of go back over everything you'd been through and face up to it. And I get the impression that when you're in lockdown and you didn't have your coping mechanisms that you had before, your friends, you're going out for drinks, your exercise, etc. Do you ever, I mean, it might never have happened, I suppose, if the circumstances were different and you may have continued the person you were before. What can we learn from that?
Yeah, and I think you're right. I often get asked that and I often wonder myself, you know, if lockdown hadn't hit, would I have got to the point where I was going to take an overdose? You know, was it all those coping mechanisms falling away? And I guess, you know, the stuff that had happened before that, you know, that had obviously done the damage inside, it would still be there. So I think I would still just be walking around the planet like a ticking time bomb, waiting to explode. So I guess I'm thankful that it did happen in a way. You know, I get asked sometimes, do I regret the overdose? And I know it's going to be a very sweeping statement to say, but I don't, even though I absolutely fully intended to end my life, but it has been, as the very, you know, seed of this conversation, it has been the one thing that's made me, because, you know, it has made me process all those things. And I think I'd be a very different person if I was just walking around with it all still locked up inside, waiting to come out. Because that takes up a lot of capacity. Having those things rattling around in your head takes up a huge amount of brain power. And it also takes up a huge, you know, those coping mechanisms that we all use to deal with it can eat into a lot of your day-to-day living time. And actually, I've really, you know, I've got busy. I've met a veteran recently and he said he had a great sentence, which was get busy living. And I love that saying. I think, you know, it's important for us all to get busy living.
Liz McConaughey, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
If you would like support or information about the issues discussed in this podcast, our website has details of organisations which can help. You can find it at bfbs.com/audience support.